Let me introduce our panel. We went and we saw last night 12 Years a Slave. We've been wanting to talk about this film for a while. I know the book very well. And I see our guests are all fingering through the copies of the book now. And we'll look at this from a number of ways. We have with us in studio here Dr. Ray Winbush, Director of the Institute for Urban Research here at Morgan State University, Dr. Kay Whitehead, Assistant Professor of Communications and Affiliate Assistant Professor of African and African American Studies at Loyola University, and a documentary filmmaker.
Yes.
Good to have you back, Kay.
Thank you.
Dr. Heather Harris is with us. It's been a while. She's back with us in the studio. Heather Harris is Associate Professor of Business Communication at Stevenson University and co-editor of The Obama Effect, Multidisciplinary Renderings of the 2008 Campaigns. Heather, good to see you again.
Thank you. Good morning.
And we're going to get Heather's mic up. And we also have with us by phone someone who used to grace our airways a lot with me over the years. It's the first time in a while she's been back with us. We're looking forward to having her back with us again. Anne Hornaday, who's film critic for The Washington Post, who wrote a very interesting piece we'll link to on our website. And Anne, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thank you. It's so nice to be back.
And you all can join us out there. Did you see the film? 410-319-8888. Did you read the book? You can write to us at steinershow@gmail.com. I'll log on to our Facebook pages, see if you've written there. And you can tweet at Mark Steiner. See what you got to say. 410-319-8888. So I take it everybody's seen the film.
Yes.
Yeah. Otherwise, yes. Why would you be here? So, so I just want to, first of all, just get initial reactions. I do at some point in the conversation want to let Anne raise the issue she raised in her piece about the changes in cinema and black folks in this world and photography and change and direction and all that that she wrote about in her piece, which I thought was really important kind of aspect of change in film in America. But let's talk about first reactions to the film. Heather, let me start with you.
Oh, boy.
That's exactly what I said. Yeah. I couldn't leave my seat.
Well, before I went to the movie, I promised myself that I would keep my eyes open. I tend to be a little squeamish, and I was concerned that I would not be able to watch a lot of the more violent scenes. So I said, okay, I'm going to keep my eyes open. I went with a girlfriend. And I sat there, and I didn't realize that my eyes were the least of the problem because the images combined with the sound, I actually stopped breathing. And so she said she wanted to know if I was okay. But I couldn't say anything. I couldn't drink anything. I couldn't eat anything. All I could do was just watch. And I could feel my chest begin to tighten at one point, and I had to say, okay, I'm not going to die in a theater watching a movie. I have to deep breathe. And so it was paralyzing. It was so painful. You know, I couldn't even cry. And not to make light of it, but I thought about the Cameron Diaz character in the movie The Holiday, where she couldn't cry because she had experienced some painful events. Watching this was just too much at one time. Just one scene after the next, one scene after the next. And you try to think about what you had just seen and connect it to what you were about to see. Very difficult to watch.
Anne Hornaday, let me go to you next, and then we'll go to Kay Whitehead.
Well, you know, I think it's fascinating that Dr. Harris just mentioned the combination of the image and the sound, because I think that's exactly why this is such a powerful work of art. I mean, obviously, it's a compelling story. Solomon Northup's story, it's just the classic journey of somebody going, you know, through the looking glass into a nightmare, living that nightmare, and then coming out. And all the acting is just superb throughout. And Chiwetel Ejiofor, who plays Northup, is our surrogate as we go into this nightmarish world. But beyond those sorts of, you know, classical storytelling elements of plot and characterization and acting and writing, I think what elevates this even more is Steve McQueen, the director, uses image and sound in a way that's almost abstract, you know. He used a very non-period musical score, you know, when you kind of break it down, even though there are gospel hymns and, you know, fiddle pieces throughout, but the actual musical score that accompanies the film is almost electronic, it's almost abstract, which I think is a really interesting aesthetic choice. And some of the, you know, what he does is he allows the audience, or invites the audience, or maybe forces the audience to really sit with these realities that he's depicting on screen, which for me is just, it all comes down to this sort of rampant pathology that affected everyone, enslaved people and enslavers alike. And I think that's what I came away with from this movie, is that it's beyond sort of a conventional Hollywood treatment of a story. it really is a great work of art.
Okay.
I had a slightly different experience, similar in some ways. I approach the story as a historian. I read the book when I was in undergraduate school, and that was my first introduction into this other world of enslavement. I'd always learned that African Americans were enslaved, and that was the full extent of our life. Reading this story and finding out about the free black communities, finding about his level of education, hearing him talking about his family and his children and his wife, introduced another element of enslavement that I had never even heard about coming through middle school and high school in Washington, D.C. It wasn't until I got to Lincoln University, a historically black college, that I was introduced to the other side, that there were very educated and talented free people that existed at that time. So when I decided to go and see the movie, I pulled back out my dog-eared copy of the book and read it again because I wanted to remind myself of what his true story was to compare it to Steve McQueen's depiction, and I thought he did an excellent job. I cried when I first read the book. I cried when I watched the movie. I didn't cry because I was surprised by what was happening. I mean, these new layers and faces of enslavement are not new to us who've been studying it. I cried because I think there's still a part of us that has to heal from this. It's just painful to watch and painful to realize that even though you live 30 years as a free person, as Frederick Douglass said, you have 12 years of being treated as a thing. And watching this being depicted on film, putting pictures to a story that had always been in my head, what was a very difficult experience. I walked out of the film, and I didn't have to remind myself to breathe. I had to remind myself to compose myself, to begin to think about it and to really think deeply about whether I was ready for my children. I have a 12 and 11-year-old boys, whether I was ready for them to see it. They know about the horrors of enslavement, but knowing about the horrors of enslavement and watching this artistic depiction are two different experiences.
Dr. Ray Winbush.
You know, I have a bad habit when I go to black films to compare them immediately to other black films. And I realized the uniqueness of 12 Years a Slave is that it had a black director, it had a black storyteller, and it had a black screenwriter. And I can only recall a handful of films that did that. I'm reminded of Julie Dash's Daughter of the Dust,
yeah.
Germina's Sankofa. And then I started thinking about these more ludicrous films like Django, which had a white director, white scriptwriter, and then as the Anne said, the film was quiet in a way. I mean, it wasn't like this jarring musical score like in Django, but it was quiet. And I've always been frustrated in reading history. When I read 12 Years a Slave years ago, of reading narratives that were powerful and then going to films that were silly, like right. Django. And this didn't do that for me. I mean, I put this in the category of Julie Dash's film, which is one of my favorite of all times, and Sankofa. But it's a unique film, very unique.
Well, we've said a lot of different things here, coming from different perspectives. Let me try to kind of parse some of these things out and talk a bit about some of this. I'm curious, and let me ask you just a cinema question. I'm curious, A, how the movie's doing, and who's going to see it. I mean, we went yesterday. We went to see it yesterday for the first time. We went to a 4:30 showing at the Charles, which was early because we had things to do. So the film wasn't filled. Maybe 20 people in the audience when we saw it, and maybe six were African American. The rest were white folks in the film. But how's the movie doing on those counts?
Well, I think it's doing reasonably well. I'm not exactly sure what the budget was, and that's always, you always have to kind of measure revenues against budget and then equal profit. But I think it's made about $9 million so far in the last, I think it was released 3 or 4 weeks ago. So my impression is that it's doing very well, and they've definitely positioned it. It's one of these films, it's part of this phenomenon of using awards season to help raise awareness about a movie. And so clearly it's going to be in competition for the major Oscar awards in all, I would imagine, across all categories. So I would suspect that the studio is really going to let this, hang out. It'll be around for a long, long time as it gains momentum. And I think it's become, because we're, we're talking about this today, it's really become a part of our cultural currency. I mean, I think to be culturally literate right now, you almost have to see it, you know. So it's reached that level of imperative viewing.
I think that – go ahead, Casey. I think that to me, that's one of the important pieces of this film and films like this that are kind of changing the landscape because it is part of a cultural literacy of people maybe are changing America and changing and kind of changing the consciousness, but addressing the consciousness, making people think about who we are and where we've come from and what we are is what a film like this does. I mean, I was comparing it this morning as I was thinking about going to the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C. And when you go there, you are physically moved because of the images that are shown of what happened to people when the Nazis ruled Europe. The torture, the killing, the humiliation, the rapes, and all the things that happened at that moment. And when you see a film like this, it's that same searing quality. I mean, when the scenes is like what actually happened to people and how that affects, which I want to get to a little bit, the kind of the effect on the unconscious of society, period, mm-hmm. for generations to come after things like that happen. That's what this film kind of represented to me. That was just so – I was just stunned by the movie. I think he's an amazing filmmaker. His film he did before that, Hunger, about – he got into deep trouble for in England as a black Brit. He made this film about the Irish struggle, and a lot of people were really upset that he made this film about the Irish struggle.
Right.
You know, so I'm sorry, Kay, you were going to say what?
Well, I agree that it is part of our cultural literacy. I just think that it's part of the cultural literacy for the people who are interested in being culturally literate. This film, like so many films like this, the ones that get into your unconsciousness, that begin to shift the way you see the world and you see yourself, oftentimes are not able to cross over to the general population. Although this is definitely in no way a study, it's not a quantitative analysis at all, but in talking to different people in different segments of population and African-American people, there's a lot of pushback against this film, mm-hmm. where they don't want to go see it. People that are right. culturally literate, my friends in academia, my friends who write, who are activists, yes, absolutely, they're lining up to see it. But when I talk to people in the barbershop where I take my sons, or in the grocery store, or when I go to the playground, I'm finding a large population of African Americans who don't want to see another film about enslavement, though it's not on the same level as Django. And it's definitely a different type of film than Roots. I find that a number of people that I'm in contact with, again, not a quantitative study, are saying enough about enslavement, enough even about Fruitvale Station. We want to see things like The Best Man, like The Newlyweds. We want to see
Baggage Claim.
We want to see Baggage. You know, we want to see.
And I like The Butler.
I like The Butler too. But we want to see people of color doing other things. And I take what they're saying very seriously. I mean, we're talking, it's 2013, and people are asking me, should we still have conversations about enslavement? What does it gain us? Are we actually healing? Or here we go again, going back into the same kind of, for some people, this cesspool of emotions where you're angry at white people, you're hurt about what happened, you don't know how to get over it, and then you come out of this with these emotions but not having any kind of answers to the problems that you're grappling with.
So Heather, you want to jump in? And we have Anne and Ray as well.
Yeah, what I see it being is an American story. I think we lose focus when we think of it as just an African-American story. This is an American story. America, the United States, I should say, like every other country, has a culture. And the culture of the United States is built upon this legacy of slavery. And so in order to heal, in order to move forward, in order to realize what the legacy of slavery is in our society for all people, not just people of African descent, but for all people, this gives us an opportunity to begin a conversation, to look at the beliefs that arose from that period, that ground the culture, and for us to now decide, are these beliefs we still want to hold fast to, or are they beliefs that we want to now question and perhaps change? Because that's the only way we're going to be able to move to a place of healing, to a place of dialogue, and to a place of more progressive thinking all around.
And I don't think we've heard enough about enslavement. I think that we've had these depictions of enslavement that have been, for me, melodramatic. I can think of Spielberg's portrayal of Amistad, which, you know, I didn't like it. You know, I mentioned earlier about Django. And I think that I've heard, what Kay said, I've heard the same kind of pushback. I don't know if I should take my children to see it. I don't want to hear anything about enslavement. And then a couple of days ago, as you probably heard, Morgan Freeman said he wasn't going to go see 12 Years of Slave.
I didn't see that.
Yeah, he actually said it. So, but I think that it's because we wish to still have this kind of gone with the wind idea of enslavement. You know, we wish to have images like Miss Scarlet, I don't know nothing about birthing no babies, rather than the hard, gritty, what actually happened to enslaved Africans. And so, I think we need more films like this. I really do. And I think that is Steve McQueen is about to do another film about the 1965 Watts Rebellion for 2015. And I think he's going to treat it the same way. He takes on these aspects of African history that have simply not been treated well on film. And I think for most black folk, you know, masses of black folk, they're not going to read the book. And this is not an elitist comment. They're not going to read the book. But at least when they go see a film, I hope that they see something that's accurate. And I think 12 Years of a Slave is accurate, more so, than some of these other things I've seen.
Ann, let me jump to you, and then we're going to open the phones. We have a lot of people calling in when you get to these calls one by one. And Ann, go ahead, then we'll open the phones.
I think what we're getting at here, and it's something, Mark, you and I have talked about. I think the last time I was on the show, we talked about Precious. And
all right.
And it was a sort of a similar phenomenon of people, you know, not wanting to they have to sit with those depictions and those images and representations. And I totally get that, but I think what this is really about is the pressure that's being, you know, because we have so few of these movies about African American life and history, enormous pressure is put on everyone to be the one, you know, to be the be all and end all. And I think what we want are more baggage claims and Jumping the Brooms and Best Man's and 12 Years of Slaves and Fruitvale Stations and Mothers of George, which is a terrific movie about.
Right.
The Nigeria, you know, so the point in 42, you know, the point is more, you know, as Dr. Wimbush said, we need more. We just need more, 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 more. And people, I would never, ever take, you know, I would never be in any kind of position of saying you have to see this. You know, everybody has their own reasons and for seeing or not seeing something. And I would never say that they're wrong for one or the other. But what I love about this year is that there has been such diversity in African American films and storytelling and characterizations, and that's exactly what we want.
Let me open the phone, so we'll come right back at 410-319-8888. Tyrone, you're on the air. Hi, Tyrone. Welcome.
Because I really do not see the point of another slavery movie. Are we to take away from this movie? What is this movie designed to do for us? Or, where is the inspiration or to uplift us as a people? Instead, that the thought of that type of history only brings us down or keep us continue to feel inferior. I mean, what is the point? You know what I mean? I get so tired of slavery movies. And do we as black people have a history beyond slavery that the movie people out there, the black movie people can talk about? As all as far as we can go back is slavery?
Well, I think everybody wants to kind of jump in on this.
Kay,
you can start.
Well, I wanted to start by thanking the call, of course, and just saying that whereas Anne said that she does not tell people to go see it, I am one telling people you must go see 12 Years a Slave. You must go see it because you do not have a clear understanding of what happened during enslavement. The caller said, what's the point of this? This opens up a different conversation than, say, Roots does.
That's right.
Than, say, even the Harriet Tubman story does. We're seeing educated black people who existed at that time, who had families, who loved each other, took care of their kids, who had talent, and then they were kind of pulled away into enslavement. That contrast is so greatly needed because our understanding of enslavement is that every black person at that time was enslaved, and that is not what was happening. There was a community of free black people running alongside the enslaved community, and they were being very helpful in trying to pull their brothers and sisters
right.
from enslavement into freedom. It happened a lot in Baltimore, where they would go up to an enslaved person and say, hey, walk away with me. That's and right. You can walk away to freedom. It happened in New York. I mean, that active Underground Railroad, we need to see educated people from that time period. So I'm telling people, go and see it. Go see it because your understanding of enslavement probably is not a true full and complete understanding of enslavement because you just think about whips and chains and being illiterate and being used and bodies on display. You don't think about the free, black, rich community that we had at that time.
We have to take a very short break. We're going to come right back. We're going to let our other guests have a say here, but we have a full body of phones. And Brian, Meredith, Alan, Gail, we're going to get your call. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Why are you playing Overture of 1812? Well, that's because Peter Ilyich Tchaikovsky died on this day in 1893, so his music will be coming during our breaks as we celebrate all those like that. We are talking now about 12 Years a Slave. On the way to do that, let me remind you the support for WEAA is provided by the Walters Art Museum, presenting the exhibition Egypt's Mysterious Book of Fayum. An ancient papyrus is displayed alongside Egyptian statues, reliefs, jewelry, and ritual objects to tell intriguing stories like that of Sobek, the crocodile god who makes the sunrise. We're talking about 12 Years a Slave with our guests, Dr. Ray Winbush, Dr. Kay Whitehead, Dr. Heather Harris, and Ann Hornaday, and you at 410-319-8888. And quick thoughts on what we just heard. So I do want to get to the phones here. There are a lot of people who want to kind of jump in. Heather, you lucky.
Yes. When I watched the movie, one of the things that also came to mind is the fact that what we saw on screen and what we heard on screen, that it was actually just the iceberg meeting the water. The horror of slavery could not possibly be depicted in that film. The true horror of it. And I think when people say, because I've had students as well say that they know of other people who don't want to see the movie because it's about slavery, they don't want to feel embarrassed. It's nothing to feel embarrassed about.
Exactly.
Right. It's nothing to feel embarrassed about. It's something to feel empowered about. Because when you think of the fact that many of us sit here because the people before us were able to endure what we saw on screen and much more. I remember as a 20-something-year-old reading the book by C.L.R. James, The Black Jacobins,
right.
about the Haitian Revolution and Toussaint Louverture and Dessalines. And one of the images in there was of a slave master digging a hole so that a pregnant woman could be beaten. So the woman was put in the hole with her stomach, face down, so that she could be beaten in order to instill fear into her and into the child. All of that has ramifications today. And so what we see on film is almost, even though it's brutal, it can still almost be slavery light. You know?
And I think that it is. I mean, these kind of things are, I think, critical for the world to wrestle with, because when a show is coming up, we're going to be talking about the unconscious sense of human beings and where it comes from, and the studies being done about why people think the way they do, mm-hmm. black or white or native or Latino, about African, about dark images, and all that is inculcated over hundreds of years. It's not something that goes away in a generation.
Right.
That's right.
So let's go back to the phones at 410-319-8888. Brian, you're on the air. Hello, welcome. Brian, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. A couple of pieces. When the film, and I'm going to try to be real quick because I know you got a lot of folks on the phone. But when the film first came out, I got into a lot of discussions with some folks in our group, and all of the opinions that you guys have stated have come across. And on a personal level, I wasn't quite sure if I wanted to go see the film myself. What convinced me to go see the film is the fact that it is a film that's told by ourselves. We're telling this story, and it's not a Hollywood adaptation of this story. I don't want to see another Hollywood version of slavery, the great white hope coming in and saving the poor Negroes. But in any case. One of the things that the film really brings out, and it's very important for us to understand, is that the nuances of slavery. The slavery has so many nuances that there are so many different stories to be told that we could make films forever about slavery and never really do it enough justice. And the reason why that's so important and is because it is central to America's history.
That's right.
Without a true understanding of the effects and the impact of slavery in today's society,
yeah,
both on the black and white community, we're really doing a lot of lip service to what's really going on, particularly in light of white supremacy. But just let me make this final point. In terms of some of the content, in the film, I think one of your guests said that this is a classical piece, a classical story. I take issue with that, and that is not classical in the sense that it is a unique story, but this story occurred repeatedly. It happened over and over and over again. And Solomon Northrop is not someone that this was just an aberration. This was something that was practiced on a regular, common, everyday basis. In William Still's work, you have his story of the Saltwater Negro and many, many other short narratives about what happened to folks who were kidnapped, children,
right,
adults, and people who, one of the reasons all the vigilance societies were established. But the content piece from Solomon's perspective is that's in the beginning of the film when he goes into the store and the slave follows a man who is brought to the north with his master and follows him into the store. His master comes in and pulls him out. Solomon Northrop doesn't really understand himself the impact of slavery, and this is what the United States was like at that time.
Ryan, I have to ask you to finish up because we have a lot of callers and we're going like 4 minutes or so.
Go ahead and pick it up and sort of get into. I would like to hear you talk about some of the details of the film, some of the content pieces.
Right, and I thought thank that. Thank you so much, and I was talking that particular scene. I thought it was a very important scene.
Oh, hugely important, and it loops back to another really crucial scene, which is when he starts to. There's a beautiful image of people singing a hymn, and he's not singing with them, and then he finally joins in. It's this very cathartic moment, and I feel like that's kind of him coming to grips with his own issue, his own class issues. You know. I mean, it's so much about identity and who you are and what you let define you and what you don't let define you and kind of where you cast your lot. And I felt like that moment when he finally joins in with this community that he does not want to be a part of and feels like he, by rights, shouldn't be a part of, it directly gets back to that scene in the store, you know, for me. And there are just so many passages like that in this movie that are so subtle, and you're right about the nuance. You know, it's there's also this whole text, not even a subtext, this entire kind of brilliant text on women, you know, and women's relationships and how, you know, the complicity of white women and the complex psychology of white women and enslaved women. I mean, it's just it's really, really deep and I think just brilliantly limed.
That's the part that I mean. It's the saga that how you tell a great filmmaker.
Yeah,
be able to put so much into a film.
That's right.
And these little scenes that set things up and bring you in and tell the story in short form.
That's right.
That embellish the story and really kind of bring the nuance out. That's
and
he's,
right.
He's a brilliant filmmaker.
And I think what it gives all of us who are privileged enough to see it is this new language. You know, it's a visual language, it's a symbolic language, it's an emotional language, it's almost a kinetic, like a physical language, that we can now process this history. And I just, you know, like somebody said earlier, it's in you now, you know? I mean, we can't unsee this. We can't unfeel this, and it's hugely potent.
I thought that was a great scene as well. I like that play on helping us to understand the class issues that existed at that time. I mean, it was happening in New York. It was happening in Philadelphia, where the free black community did not feel connected to the formerly enslaved community. You would run away to freedom, but you would not be completely accepted into that free black community around the issues around education and around the amount of money that you had. Yeah. So I thought that was an amazing scene that kind of made you think about what what was happening within the black community, that everybody was not on the same level. You had a class system even within the black community.
You did, but there's other accounts you read of people's histories that happened in the 1830s, 40s, and 50s who were aware, like when the Fugitive Slave Act was passed in 1851, a lot of free black folks in the North who lived in Michigan and New York State went to Canada.
That's right.
Not to be able to, because they, and then join the abolitionist movement.
Absolutely.
Because that was like this cutting edge moment.
Right.
That said, you know, that you too can be snatched.
Exactly.
And were.
Baltimore was one of the cities where more free blacks were snatched than any other place in the country.
Had the largest free population of any urban center in America.
That was that other part of the Underground Railroad, going in the opposite direction, going from freedom into enslavement. The other thing about Steve McQueen, if people were able to just go back and pull up off of the MTV clip, where you can see that painting behind Kanye West, the lynching tree, that he has this play with light. And with images, and this subtle way of getting at issues that we should actually take a look at. Like, take a look at the film again. Mm-hmm. Remove your emotions from it and watch it again from an artistic.
I want to get to the phones here, but I do want to come back. And I want you to kind of outline the piece you wrote about the artistic end of this, because I think it's important for us to wrestle with as well. 410-319-8888. Let's go to Meredith, line 4.
Good morning, all. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
I think for me, and I am going to see the film. I haven't seen it yet, but a lot of my friends have. I think for me, for a lot of folks that don't want to see the film, I feel like America sanitizes history. So we don't want to see anything that doesn't make us feel good or gives us a level of discomfort that we do not yet have the tools to handle. And because this issue of slavery and how basically it has created an American psychosis along with the genocide of Native Americans, we have yet to deal with this as a country. And then we want to know why the president gets all these type of death threats and levels of disrespect, and nobody wants to go back, unpack the bag, and really and truly embark on the path of healing. And I would hope that more movies are made like this, so that people can develop the tools to effectively heal, so that we can move forward in this country. Because until this issue around slavery and the psychosis and the madness that it has caused in this country, and literally has caused America to go around the world and try to replicate this, okay, until we deal with that, we will forever be trapped in this space. And so I open ways to open the wound, so that we can heal and truly hear the voices of our ancestors for our own prosperity and freedom.
Absolutely.
Heather, and then we'll go to
Just
Ann.
To add a little bit to what the caller is saying, I agree in that we cannot understand the United States unless we understand slavery, because slavery is directly and intricately linked to capitalism as it exists in the United States. If we don't understand slavery, if we don't understand the beliefs and the values and traditions that come out of slavery, we can't understand how capitalism exists. We can't understand why schools in Baltimore City, for example, look the way they do compared to schools in the counties. We can't understand why the prisons are filled with certain types of people as opposed to others. We can't understand why third grade boys are looked upon as potential prisoners by the people who build jails. We can't understand all of that if we don't understand the foundation.
And I think that it's the very foundation of capitalism itself. There would be no Western capitalism if it had not been for slavery.
Yes.
Slavery built
right.
Capitalism of the West.
That's right.
let me switch gears here for a moment, because I want Anne to kind of focus in on what you wrote in your piece about how this is what's changing cinematically, and I'd like Ray Wimbush to comment when he hears it. Anne?
Well, you know, one thing that struck me, and this gets back to what a year it's been for African American film, and again the diversity of images, and one piece of that diversity is skin tone. You know, we've seen so many wonderful black actors coming into their own of various hues and shades. And when I was watching 12 Years, one of the very first shots is of Solomon when he's enslaved in Louisiana. It's a nighttime scene. It's probably lit only by candlelight. And he's with another an enslaved woman who's of a much lighter skin tone. And it's a beautiful, it's almost painterly the way it's lit. And it's very low light, but it's very detailed, and you can get, you know, you get this very rich sense of their varying skin tones. And then I saw this movie that I spoke about earlier called Mother of George by Andrew Dosunmu, which again just has these gorgeous images of the Nigerian immigrant community in Brooklyn, various skin tones, a lot of them very dark. And I was thinking about how historically, literally, the medium of film was built on the demonization and distortion of black skin and black bodies. If you go back to The Birth of a Nation, which helped invent our cinematic grammar, that was, you know, obviously a vicious distortion of black characters played by white people in blackface in that movie. And through the years, when films were made on celluloid photochemical film stock, those film stocks were manufactured for sensitivity to light skin. They were literally not made to film black people. So when African American actors started to appear in films, they were usually poorly lit or overlit. I brought this up with Steve McQueen, and he said, you know, the reason why Sidney Poitier is sweating so much in the heat of the night isn't because it's in the South, although it was. It's because he has so many lights on him.
Right.
So I really wanted to explore the issue of when racism is built in to the industry and the industrial practice and the aesthetic practice of a medium, how that, you know, what that does, and now how these filmmakers like Steve McQueen and this cinematographer named Brad Young, and a lot of these cinematographers who happen to come out of Howard, like Arthur Jaffa, who shot Daughters of the Dust, how they have either worked within that system to create images of black beauty, which is inherently political, or now, with the advent of digital filmmaking tools, that structural impediment has now disappeared, and we're seeing this beautiful blossoming, that's the only way I can put it, of black images and beauty.
I've got a filmmaker friend of mine, and he calls it the Fuji film phenomenon.
Yes.
Back when film was film, black folk knew that Fuji film portrayed them better in pictures than Kodak.
Right.
And so there was like this urban, it was not more just an urban legend, but black folk they were eating up Fujifilm.
I heard that same thing. Dr. Wimbush. Yeah,
yes.
Somebody mentioned that to me too, because it was manufactured in a place that wasn't predicated on white film.
Exactly.
Right. That's interesting.
And American film is, yeah.
I personally used Fujifilm when I took pictures. I loved it. But you know, Ms. Hornaday says is that what you're seeing more now is that people of African descent are also controlling, to some degree, the modes of production.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
As opposed to just a text.
That's mm-hmm. right.
And so by doing so, you are able to have lighting that's appropriate. You are able to have shots that are complementary, because you're seeing through your own gaze as opposed to someone else seeing you through theirs.
Mm-hmm.
And when you do that, you're going to get a very different outcome
that's
than you
right.
would normally get. That's why Oprah always looks so good on her show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because she's in control.
She was in control.
That's right.
I just don't think it's a blossoming, though. I think it's been happening for a while. I went to film school in 95, and my cinematographer was from Howard University. And when we were making my first film in New York, we were wrestling with this Fuji mm-hmm. phenomenon. We were wrestling with finding ways for black people to look beautiful on film. It's making its way into bigger films now.
Well, that's the
blossoming. But it's been happening.
But the blossoming is that it's making its way.
But we've been wrestling with this for a long time.
Yeah.
I mean, we would have to shoot in New York. We could only shoot on sunny days and put our, you know, our black actors in very bright colored clothes so they would look beautiful and natural and real and wouldn't sweat like Sidney Poitier.
He sweated in Lilies of the Field, too.
410-319. It's a reflection off all those habits. 410-319-8888. I'm sorry. Let's go to the phones. A couple quick calls in a row here. Kenyatta, you've been holding on for a while. You're on the air.
All right. Thank you. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Good morning.
All right. Peace. Alafiafuni. And assalamu alaikum, salam. I want to say, you know, make a point. I have not seen the film yet. I guess I'm going to try to, but I'm one of those who are, like, very much tired of seeing slave films. It's one of the things that did not motivate me, but it did motivate me, I should say, but it didn't. I don't think it really much empowered me as much as my studies taken me to find out that we were the founders of civilization. Our bloodline was, our ancestors were the founders of civilization, pretty much domesticating, growing fruits, you know, and things of this nature, putting up great cities, you know, and to know that we dealt with a small area of freedom in here in the United States, but a mass majority being slaves. You follow? I kind of don't like even want to feed off it, because to the conscious mind, or those who are not conscious or who have not studied, what these films portray to them is you're still a slave. You're this is all you are. This is all you ever be. But to those of us, like the sister said earlier, those of us that have studied, you know, we look at it a little bit deeper, okay? We do look at it. We look for the bigger picture of what's being said, what's being portrayed to us. But if we have films, see, I'm speaking about only feeding the conscious, you know, because we have a hard time out here trying to reach, trying to grasp these brothers and sisters who do not read, who have not even walked that path to go and study a little bit more about their culture. You know, they take things on face value.
Okay, Kenny, we only have a few minutes left, and I'm going to get other callers in, because I'm going to just ask you to kind of wrap up your analysis. Kenyatta?
Yes, sir.
Go ahead.
Okay, basically what I'm saying is we need to have films that are empowering, showing the royalty, showing the civilized actions of our ancestors, the growth of our ancestors
okay.
before slavery. Thank you.
Thank you, Kenyatta.
I want to say something real quick. I don't think we've had a lot of films about enslavement. I mean, this year, too. Django, whatever,
yeah.
and 12 years.
Django is a comic book.
Yeah.
Right. It really is.
Spaghetti Western.
And which entertainment comic book.
The most common film driven and given to black folk in this country is the romantic comedy
yeah.
or in the Tyler Perry genre. We don't have a lot of films about enslavement. I would challenge most of us to just think of five that we've had, and Roots will be on that list.
Always.
And Beloved will be on that list. 12 years and Django right now. And maybe, you know, Sankofa. But we don't have a lot of films about that. I think it's kind of an urban myth. We've got a lot of films about enslavement when we really don't.
I think there were some parts of the film that were empowering. I mean, the scene
right.
where he was being beaten and he was able to turn that around.
Standing
and
on
do,
his tiptoes.
Yes, and, you know, so that he does not die. I mean,
that's
when
right.
he ran away into the woods, there were parts of this film that I found to be very empowering, that they show that enslaved people did fight back.
And I think it was also important, a little piece of this film showed about this, is that people always talk about why didn't people run away more.
Yes.
I think the film also showed the near impossibility of doing that
yes.
when you were in the situation you
right,
were in.
Right.
How do you get from Louisiana to Canada? You know, it's not, this is,
right.
it's that's why I think the subtleties, again, that Steve McQueen, the way he told the story was a lot like he did with Hunger. I mean, he just really knows how to get under an issue
that's right.
and tease out the reality so that if you really sit and think about the films he does, You have to come away with wrestling with reality in ways you don't with everybody else's film. I think
he's brilliant.
He's one of my
brilliant.
New
yeah.
favorite
yeah.
filmmakers.
No doubt.
Yeah.
I remember hearing a graduate student talk about a book that he wrote, it was maybe 2 years ago, about slave rebellions, successful slave rebellions in the American South. Those are the type of films that people would need to see as well. Those are part of the variety that need to come out to show that people were not just powerless, that they were
right.
in fact and did in fact overcome their oppressors, but to show that.
But even in those, the stories of people who revolted when they were successful, they were usually in the Upper South.
Yes.
Right. They were out at sea.
There's a brilliant book, got to plug it, from my old former professor, John O. Franklin's book, Runaway Slave.
Oh,
is
my word, that's
excellent.
Amazing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Exactly.
Amazing.
Very good book.
Did you say something, Ann? You just said amazing. Was that you saying amazing as well?
I'm sorry?
I thought I heard you. Who said amazing?
I said amazing.
You said amazing. Okay.
That's because anything by John Hope Franklin is absolutely amazing.
I agree.
So let's try to get another caller here if we can. We have one, maybe we can get one or two in. Barrick, you're on the air. Hi, Barrick, on line five. No, four. You're on the
four.
Air. Barrick, you're on the air?
How are you?
Good. We don't have a lot of time, so I'm asking you.
I know. I'm going to make it really brief. Thank you, first of all, for having this whole panel. I want to congratulate everyone.
Thank you.
I do respect the approach to a 12 years a slave. However, you know, I'm disturbed at Hollywood's desire to revisit the slave trade over and over again.
But let me stop you right there, because what Ray Winbush just said was name the movies that in the last 10 years that have been made about the slave trade. Can you name 5 movies, 10 movies?
Why aren't we as entertained at the magnificence of Reginald F. Lewis? Why aren't movies made about that? Some current success. You know, some current success of people such as Reginald F. Lewis, you know, Far Gray. You know, these are the things that young men such as myself and young black women and anyone can be truly inspired. Why to constantly revisit the slave trade over and over again when you have individuals such as this and more? You know, I'm disturbed by Hollywood's constant want to revisit the slave trade constantly.
But what I'm asking, Barak, I hear what you're saying. I think there have to be all kinds of films made in our society, and things need to kind of really grow in the world of film. But again, I think Ray Wimber's challenged earlier to say, name the films about slave trade that were made. Like what?
Well, Roots.
If
you want to throw The Butler in there. But my point again,
that was about slavery. It was about a man who
just as inspired as we are of the gentleman escaping the slave trade after being recaptured, you know, I'm just as inspired to hear about how Reginald F. Lewis, you know, made an empire, you know, by his own mind, not by throwing a ball or singing a song.
Okay,
you know, these are the things we need, you know.
Very quick comments from our panel.
Well, again, I think it's kind of more of an urban legend that there's a bunch of films about enslavement. Roots was 40 years old. You may want to talk about Gone with the Wind, 70 years old, you know. But there's not a lot of films made about enslavement. And I agree with the callers that we need more films about Egypt and what I would call Kemet all the way through what Africa was doing during Timbuktu, which is a poem, and I didn't even know that. But I think that we've got to look at enslavement as part, as you said, the American fabric. It is part of it.
And I want to note he wasn't recaptured. He was actually born free. His father had been emancipated.
He was born free and then
taken into slavery. He was not recaptured. I just want to make sure people are clear.
We have like 90 seconds left here. I just think that one of the things would be interesting to explore are films that actually, in their context, have black casts that talk about the modern world, which we don't see very much. I think maybe that's part of the sentiment we're hearing here from people.
Well, but you know, I think we are seeing, and this gets to my blossoming. I mean, I take the point that it's not a blossoming, but there is a blossoming going on with this very exciting generation of African American filmmakers, like people like Ava DuVernay and Dee Reese and Andrew Dasanmu and Barry Jenkins and John Ridley, who wrote 12 Years a Slave, but he has a movie about Jimi Hendrix coming out.
That's right. Yes. That's right.
It's just beautiful. I mean, it's just, so I do think we are seeing more. We need more. I mean, if there's a takeaway from this conversation, it's that we just need more. And I feel like filmmakers like the ones I just mentioned are creating contemporary dramas. They're not in those Tyler Perry, you know, they're not in any of those niches. These are just grounded dramas of telling the truth about black life in America today. And again, just, you know, I'm thrilled to see it, and I want to see more from them.
Ann Hornaday is film critic for The Washington Post, Dr. Heather Harris, a professor at Stevenson University, author of The Obama Effect, Dr. Kay Whitehead, professor at Loyola University, author of the forthcoming book, Notes for a Colored Girl, The Civil War, Pocket Diaries of Emily Frances Davis, Dr. Ray Winbush, Director of Institute for Research, Urban Research here at Morgan State University. Thank the four of you so
much.
Thank you.
We're going to take a brief break and come back. And when we return, we'll be joined by some of our city officials and more to talk about what's going on here. And don't go away with us. Stay with us. That was putting too many words together one time. Don't go away. Stay with us. We'll be right back.